All right, Crip Nation, listen up. Bryce here, as always, with Pizza Mind. And we got a big announcement for you today. Actually, the biggest announcement we've ever had on Crypto 101 ever. And we are going to announce that we are having the Crypto 2020 Summit. It's 50 of the greatest minds in crypto sharing their predictions for the crypto market and all the technology that's going to be built and price predictions and all sorts of fun stuff for the year of 2020. So it's going to take place January 29th to January 31st. We're going to be with like the founders of top coins, almost all the top coins actually, hedge fund managers, everybody. And they're going to be sharing the predictions. And the best part of this whole thing that we're hosting here, it's called Crypto 2020 Summit. Virtual, so you could listen to all this stuff for free from the comfort of your own home. It's online. You just sign up. You go to www.crypto2020summit.com. Everybody who we've had on the show, they're all going to be there. It's all free. It's going to be a great time. You got to come join us. www.crypto2020summit.com and come fill your dome with a bunch of knowledge, all sorts of fun predictions for the year 2020. So if you don't want to miss out, www.crypto2020summit.com. And today we've got a great guest. Enjoy the show. We love you, Crypt Nation, and we hopefully will see you there. What is up, good citizens of Crypt Nation? I hope you guys are having a great morning, noon, or night, wherever you are in the world. Just know you're in the right place because we got a pretty kick-ass episode today. What do you say, Pete?
Even if you're lost in time and don't know where you are, you're in the right place because you're here with Crypto 101. And in the house, we have Neil Van Hughes from Blockfills, who's going to educate us today on some trading things. And we're going to ask a lot of interesting questions. I'm really excited to learn.
Yes.
Let's bring him in, Bryce. Can we bring him in right now? Or do you got more?
No, I mean, I'm just going to say Neil is the partner and director of sales and trading at Blockfills. And Neil, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Happy to be here.
Oh man, we're going to have a lot of fun because it's not so often that we get graced with the presence of a big time trader.
Oh, I don't know if you want to go right there, right to that, but certainly have done my fair share. But you know, really we're just a growing company and looking forward to educate, work with people and better the ecosystem for the future.
Well, heck yeah. So let's just start off at the top. What is OTC, over-the-counter trading? And more importantly, why is it such a vital component of both the traditional finance world and the crypto asset finance world?
Yeah, sure. So really OTC trading is pretty simple. It's almost primitive in nature. It's really just two participants communicating together either via phone call, chat, conversation to agree upon a price and quantity at any place and time to purchase or sell any type of asset. OTC trading has been around, you know, many years, many asset classes with a number of different institutions and individuals. But you know, for us, crypto trading kind of really got its footprint on a bigger level through OTC trading in the last couple of years.
That's really amazing.
Yeah, so I mean, really, OTC trading was brought up for people to, you know, minimize their counterparty risk in this space. Crypto has always been a little bit insecure, depending on the participant who's involved. And I think what OTC in this space does is it allows people to understand who they're trading with, the security of trading with that counterparty, and knowing that the trades that they do will actually get done and they'll get delivered and people that they're trading with, you know, are qualified participants. And so really OTC trading became important when people were afraid to fund accounts at exchanges or trade with people directly. And, you know, certainly that's benefited the larger ecosystem in crypto trading.
So is OTC something that is kind of new or has it been around all this time since the beginning and a lot of people are just learning about it now
for crypto, you mean?
Of sums? Yeah.
So, I mean, I would say that OTC trading's probably been around maybe three and a half years now. I would say that, you know, the market was probably pretty small back in 2015, but 16, certainly 17 and all of 18, OTC trading was probably one of the most dominant sources of volume in crypto trading.
Awesome. I want to hear a story. So I want to hear the story about maybe like the craziest day ever trading Bitcoin. Yeah. Or yeah, let's start there. Craziest day ever trading Bitcoin.
I mean, craziest day of trading Bitcoin, not really just speaking to the OTC market, but you know, craziest day that I personally have witnessed, you know, through, you know, our business Block Fills would be probably right around this time last year when we are actually in London sponsoring the Finance Magnates Conference, which we're doing again here this coming week. And we were showcasing our liquidity in an electronic fashion, which is our core business. And we were up in this conference with a lot of other large competitors, and the market started breaking through that 6,500, 7,000 level and started heading south. And the market was moving as fast as I've seen it move since I've participated in it. And spreads on exchanges were blowing out to $200, maybe $150 to $250 wide on even a Bitcoin. Some exchange UIs were going down and clients couldn't even access them. But our market was running and we were about $50 wide on 1,000 Bitcoin, which was really revolutionary in what we were showcasing at the time. So when that market started to break, the activity was really unbelievable. And at that time, really people were staring at our screens at the conference and we were all just watching the market just, you know, fall apart. And luckily a bid came in there at some point and it stabilized and everybody was trading around in that 3,000 to 6,000 range for quite some time. But that's definitely probably one of the craziest times I've watched in the market recently.
So I mean, that's amazing. I vividly remember that day too, and everybody was kind of just losing their crap. But like, what is the, I mean, is there a reason or was there a telltale sign that that the 6,500 level was going to break? Like, why does something like that happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's maybe a couple of things that go into all this. Certainly, where market makers sit and where the risk is. Certainly, where the appetite from a supply and demand standpoint was. I think back then, if you look at what was maybe some things going on behind the scenes, was miners were really having a tough time, and they were trying to decide, you know, do they sell Bitcoin to stay in business? Can they find ways to finance growth to mine more? You know, do they hold Bitcoin? Does Bitmain make a move into Bitcoin Cash, right? Like all these things were happening and decisions were being made on the supply and demand front back then. And institutions were just, you know, getting on different sides of the market. And I don't mean institutions by asset managers or banks or something like that. I mean, you know, the largest traders in the business, right? And so, you know, I think everyone just started to kind of see the market get a little complacent. And by then, there was just not a lot of demand on the buy side. And so the market went lower. And so that's the way I look at what happened. And, you know, that's just my opinion. But I certainly remember there being a lot of discussion from the mining community on what came next and where prices were going. And they were starting to get the jitters a little bit.
Do you think news really plays that big effect in these orders, you know, whether they come, I mean, we're talking like these huge, you know, 1 minute candles that can swing a price $1,000 one way or the other. Do you think the news really plays any kind of factor into that? Or is it just one person's opinion out of nowhere?
Yeah. My 10 cents is that news does not hold a ton of weight. I think that there's guys always positioning. I think that up until parts of this year, a lot of these larger orders were being done by, you know, fairly unsophisticated principals on exchange. And, you know, a lot of market makers have strategies that that allow them to feel out those orders on exchanges and move back in the book and make these guys pay for a lot of slippage. And so when you talk about these large candles on exchange, I think they're done by, you know, unsophisticated participants. And a lot of that has changed with smart order routing, smart brokerages, you know, our liquidity aggregation techniques, off exchange volume, OTC trading. You know, a lot of that has gone away. And so I think news does not penetrate the market as much as I think, you know, supply demand does and where market makers are leaning. So in this particular market, I really think that if I were to put a percentage on it, you know, market news drives price, I don't know, maybe at a 10 to 20% basis.
I have so many questions for you. this is awesome. Okay, so I guess I'll start with, like, who's your main customer? Are you typically liquidating BTC and ETH for miners? And then the follow-up question to that is, like, what is the average order size that you post both on the bid and the ask?
Yeah, those are great questions, actually, because it's vastly different than an exchange. We're not an exchange. We don't run an exchange business. Our customers, I would say the majority of OTC desks, you know, serious OTC desks globally have access to our prices. I would say that a lot of our traders are principal trading desks, OTC desks, hedge funds, which are crypto only and traditional hedge funds, you know, really, and then the brokerage business, right? There's a lot of other guys that are out there that use bridge networks and APIs to give their clients access on a brokerage basis to crypto trading. And those guys, you know, penetrate our prices. So those are the type of participants we have. The biggest traders are without a doubt, you know, the guys that are handling their risk from you know, a number of different types of trading strategies. They could be trading against derivatives. They could be trading OTC. They could be trading event-driven strategies, relative value strategies, et cetera. So, you know, those are the types of traders that we try to support the best. They're definitely professional and institutional in nature. We obviously don't have a retail following. So, you know, that's that. And then I would just say that miners come in and do deals. You know, they definitely do deals to get trades done to you know, to get some liquidity. But we're really, in the mining front, we're working with guys more on structured deals to get them access to dollars so that they don't have to get rid of their BTC. So, I mean, we're doing trade finance, we're doing structured products, swaps that allow these guys access to dollars to grow their business without necessarily selling their BTC.
Does all the volume that comes through OTC desks around the world, is that included in the CoinMarketCap's 24-hour volume metrics? Or is there a different way to see all the volume that's actually coming through the OTC desks? Or is it, are we all just blind to it?
No, I think that one's a little bit of a tough question. I mean, I think everyone's going to have their own opinion on it, but I look at the largest OTC participants as guys who have their own supply of crypto. And so many of them are just frequently matching buy and sell orders daily, looking at their net exposure and, you know, managing that risk internally. Some of it they might cover, some of it they might hold. So to be honest with you, that one's really tough. I'm not really sure if it's accurate. I don't think as much of it is going out onto exchange as people might think. So I think there's a fair share of it that doesn't touch CoinMarketCap or exchanges.
Interesting. So, like, would you call BlockFills a market maker? Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah. So actually, the best way to look at us is a liquidity provision technology company in the crypto asset space and a market maker. So we do make our own prices in certain places with certain participants, but really our job is to create a professional institutional venue for people to do business and manage risk and execute trades. And so really we provide a front-end trading platform, an API for access to our liquidity, and we aggregate liquidity from a number of non-exchange participants that we have exclusive or semi-exclusive arrangements with, and we make that liquidity available to clients directly.
Okay, interesting. So would you say that your firm is direction neutral in regards to price?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, BlockFills is not taking a ton of principal risk. On occasion, on a one-off OTC deal, it's possible that we might.
What is principal risk? Meaning like you go long Bitcoin?
Yeah, right. We would actually take on the risk of the direction there, and we would trade against the counterparty and we would hold that position.
Okay.
Most of what we do is all back-to-back trading. So imagine just like people do with OTC, they buy from one counterparty and that counterparty manages their risk however they choose to do that. We're essentially back-to-backing trades between our clients and our counterparties. So it's riskless
trading. And you're just making money off the spread.
We'll make money on spreads and we'll make money on trading fees. So just like an exchange charges a trading fee to do business on electronic liquidity, our venue is an electronic liquidity provision venue. So we do charge electronic trading fees for groups that are, you know, high volume players. There are some groups that ask for all in net prices and we can deal that to them electronically. And there are some clients that only trade with us OTC. And essentially what we do there is when they make a price with us, we execute it on our system internally and basically, you know, back to back that trade like we would normally in an electronic fashion.
Cool. That makes sense. I imagine, I mean, since you guys started a crypto firm, you guys are generally like bullish on the long term of Bitcoin. Is that an accurate statement?
So more broadly speaking, we're super bullish on digital assets, right?
I feel like there's probably a mega temptation to like get longer and longer every opportunity you see.
Well, I mean, running a business like this, you do end up owning, you know, a little bit of crypto one way or another, or, you know, in some cases we might hold a lot of it. So there are definitely times where we're exposed. And we do have our own, you know, our own perspective and sentiment on you know, how long we want that risk to be held. But we do, you know, we are traders at heart, and you know, we do hedge most of our risk. So, you know, I wouldn't say that we're a firm that likes to speculate on whether Bitcoin's going up or down long term. We are, you know, bullish digital assets in a big way. We think, you know, it's here to stay. I think blockchain technology is not going away, but to sit here and say we want to take a significant risk on Bitcoin every day is not accurate.
Let's back it up just for a second. There's some people that are listening right now that aren't traders but might be interested in becoming one in the future. Let's talk. Let's just define a few terms real quick. What is a market maker and what is a counterparty?
Sure. So. To start with a counterparty, it would be someone that you're facing off against, you're trading with. So in our ecosystem, to make it simple, our counterparties are the people we source our liquidity from. Our clients are people who onboard with Blockfills through AML KYC, become a client, and that client is allowed to execute against our counterparty's liquidity in our ecosystem directly against Blockfills. So what we do is we sit in the middle. We do not let our clients and our counterparties trade against one another. We basically execute that trade with the client, and then we go and execute our back-to-back trade with our counterparties. And so our counterparties in this instance are liquidity providers, and our clients are people who are looking to buy and sell digital assets.
So if we just use an analogy to make sure I understand correctly, so the clients are kind of like blackjack players, and you guys would be the dealer essentially, and then the other blackjack players would be the counterparties. Is that correct?
Or the house, right? Because the house is absorbing the risk, yeah. Right? So the counterparty is taking all the risk here. We're essentially just making a medium of exchange for the counterparties to be able to show their risk and another client to be able to execute against it.
Okay, cool. So the counterparty is the house, you guys are the dealer, clients are the blackjack players.
Yep. So in this instance, our counterparties are the market makers. So a market maker is anyone who is making a price discovery in any particular asset class or pair. So if you're talking about Bitcoin against dollar, you know, a market maker is someone who's showing you a price on both the buy side and the sell side to purchase or sell Bitcoin and get dollars in return for that, or you know, dollars to buy Bitcoin and get Bitcoin in return for that.
Very cool. Is there ever, like, have you ever heard from a miner if they are going to lever up, like go longer than they already are, or do they already have too much like risk exposure?
No, there's definitely times where these guys utilize derivatives to gain exposure to one side of the environment or another, to leverage their balance sheet so that they can grow, but also, you know, basically, you know, get leverage to grow their business and hold their Bitcoin. So I would say that, you know, there's a lot of times people for the last couple of years have been out in the space talking about miners sell Bitcoin, you know, in droves and in huge amounts. You know, I would say that's highly inaccurate. The experience that we have is that, you know, they absolutely want to keep their Bitcoin for as long as they can. That's what they're in business for. And so they frequently sell as little as they can to stay in business and lever their balance sheets to be able to grow.
Well, you heard it here first, folks. The miners are more bullish than you.
In many, many senses, I would say that, but there's definitely some seriously bullish people out there.
Just to detract again, real quick, I want to talk about why a liquid market is really, really important and provide another analogy for our listeners. So imagine a liquid market with market makers, like what Bitcoin, like what Ethereum and many others have. That's like going to Walmart. You have the shelves greatly stocked. No matter if you want 24 rolls or 24,000 rolls of toilet paper, you can order it right there. It's all going to cost you pretty much the same price. However, an illiquid market or something that doesn't have a market maker on it is going to be more like a gas station in Venezuela. You might find a loaf of bread.
Jesus.
You might find a loaf of bread. It might cost you, you know, $13. It might cost you $100. You have no idea. And you're going to say, oh my God, I can't believe I have to pay that price for the loaf of bread. Or they may say, well, this loaf of bread is $5. But if you want more than one, it's going to cost you $20 because the scarcity of this bread in that region. And that would be called slippage or a spread. So these are things that market makers take care of. So all the buyers have enough to buy at a fair price. Super, super important.
I love that. That's really well said.
Yeah, very well said.
So let's talk about some of the... Actually, before we move on to this next question, let me just ask you real quick, who is the most prominent traditional institution that's playing in our space right now? What are they up to? What are they doing?
I'm not sure if I'm allowed to talk about stuff like that.
Okay, no worries. No worries. You know, let's move right along.
There's probably a strong list of 10. Some are more vocal than others, but there's some really great institutions playing in the space. We're really encouraged by that. You know, we speak to these guys frequently. We work with a number of them. And I think the idea here is that, you know, when you look at market making, like you said, and its importance in price discovery for any asset class, you know, you have guys like us that come from principal derivatives trading, you know, here in Chicago at all the major exchanges, you know, that are in all the primary asset classes. And, you know, the rest of our partners here at Blockfills are, you know, ex-heads of Forex at banks, hedge funds, et cetera. You know, we think price discovery is so important. And so, you know, our approach in late 2017 and all of the last 2 years was, you know, providing fair and transparent pricing for, you know, developing asset classes. And so, you know, the idea here is to focus on these really prominent institutions and what they do and how they do it, and make sure that it's standardized and fair and equitable and safe in this space. And I think that our solution is attractive for many of them. And we like to think that as we grow things, we'll make new products and services available to those types of clients.
That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, for what it's worth, like, you know, everybody has their own theories and stuff. I definitely think that, like, with Facebook's entrance into the crypto market, like, I got to imagine they have some type of dark pool or, you know, trading desk. It would only make sense to me, but no sense in speculating on any of that. What are some of the other world events and, like, macro policies that are going, that are, you know, unfolding, whether it's negative interest rates or QE and all that kind of stuff? What do you think is the most, like, influential or significant thing that is happening in the world that is causing Bitcoin prices or crypto asset prices to fluctuate?
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I'm not exactly sure at this point that Bitcoin is a mature enough market for us to say that those world economic policies and you know, geopolitical risks are actually moving markets per se. I would say that the better way to look at it is, like, look at Africa. If these people are unbanked, digital assets is how they get banked, right? And so if we're looking at the digital asset space as a whole, I think Bitcoin right now, its largest influence in price discovery is how many people can get access to it and the constraints at which their governments make it possible for them to have these assets. So, you know, the world events of, you know, rebellion in the Hong Kong, China regions, acceptance versus rejection of these products. If you look at, you know, Africa, like we talked about, if you start to look at the negative interest rate landscape and you know, big wealth globally that's sitting in banks, you know, not making any money, I think people are looking at allocations into stuff like Bitcoin, back into gold, you know, different things like this. And if you look at, I just got a document from a leading VC and fund in the digital asset space. Gold's about a $7.5 trillion market. And I think if you look at Bitcoin, it's what, 200-ish billion. And we said, look, if you could transfer some of that market share into this market share, imagine what it could do, right? And so if you look at this space, I think the unbanked and the discrepancies that are taking place globally and the fairness of banking, I think that's where you're seeing the demand for Bitcoin and other assets like this.
Very, very interesting. I never thought about that. Can you give us a high level what's going on with the trade wars and the currency wars between China and the US? Like, we haven't really heard any kind of credible news source. So I just wanted to get your opinion on someone that works with money every day. What's your take on it?
Yeah, they're really trying to like race to devalue their currencies. And how does that affect the average consumer?
Well, I think it's kind of interesting. If you look at, you know, the difference between, you know, and I think this is one of the other things you guys might want to dive into is the difference between QE and what's happening now is really they don't have much of a choice. As other economies are already into a negative interest rate territory, and you look at what's happened to the dollar from the beginning of 2019 until now, and that price ceiling and floor that we're experiencing or where the government in the US seems to take action, it really starts to show me that it's not like they're racing to devalue the currency. It's almost like they have no other choice. And to do that is what fuels the consumer growth still and keeping growth in such a way where economies can evolve. Because if you turn that off, I think you'd find that it just comes to a screeching halt. And you know, so that's kind of what I'm seeing. And it really, if you just pull up a chart of the US dollar and you look at where the dollar started to move this year, September, where the market for the dollar was in beginning of 2019 versus looking back in 2016, I think you'll really start to just paint the picture of where you see the government start to intervene and how that affects rates. And now the difference between how it affected rates before versus where the government's taking action now in their bond purchase programs. So it's super interesting. It's a total game of chess, but I think that's, you know, what I'm seeing. It's not really a race to devalue. It's forced devaluing because they really don't have a lot of other choices.
That is insanely fascinating.
Yeah, pull up a dollar chart when you get a chance and look at where the government started to intervene again after raising rates, and you'll see that there's this nice little window where they're participating in, and it's a wall. And if it goes any different than that, things start to get dicey.
And how does that affect the average person? I know that you need to keep the economy going because if you don't, you know, you lose jobs, but you also devalue the savings. Is this just kind of the lesser of two evils?
Yeah, well, it's really tough for me to say because the how it affects the consumer in different geographies is vastly different, right? You know, how it's affecting China and how it's affecting us is so different. In our economy, the last recession we saw was credit infused in a mortgage sense, right? Now, if you look at the health of the U.S. homeowner from a standpoint of the housing economy is in a completely different state than it was, you know, back in 2008. Today, if you look at China and India and, you know, what China's planning for the next 10 or 20 years, you know, they don't have a lot of choice but to keep the consumer growing. If they don't, I mean, it completely shuts down the growth of their economy for the next 10, 20, 50 years. And, you know, those are plans that China looks at different than how we do. I mean, I just read something the other day from global aircraft manufacturers saying that like every 10 years, air tourism doubles in size, right? And so China's looking at building airports the size of some cities. And they're saying, how can we get the people that have never ridden in an airplane or traveled anywhere outside of, you know, mainland China, we're going to get them access for the first time to being able to afford flying, right? And so what will that mean for tourism? What will that mean for access to air travel and demand in China? And it's crazy. I mean, I definitely encourage people to look this stuff up. And to me, that's how you get a picture of how it affects the consumer. If China can't continue to grow and stuff like that gets put on hold, I mean, it absolutely makes it impossible for people who are trying to get out of poverty or rise into different classes, access to certain things that other people in the globe have had access to for 30 years.
That's awesome. And there was something earlier that you mentioned that I wanted to kind of circle back on, because it's just something that nobody talks about, nobody knows. But you said the government is buying back bonds. Is that correct? Can you talk a little bit about that?
They're buying and they're repurchasing bonds. So they're buying bonds at the short end of the curve in the U.S. Treasury complex, and they're repurchasing bonds. So there's kind of like a twofold program here that they've started on since September.
Can you just go into that? So are you talking about, you know, they're buying 2 year, like the government's buying their own debt to get that yield?
Yeah, certainly.
Is that what's happening?
Yeah, certainly they've been financing this for a number of years. That was part of the QE program. But what they were doing back then was they were focusing on the back end of the treasury curve, which was mortgage rates, because everyone was in shambles during the mortgage crisis, right? So they were bailing out banks, they were bailing out, you know, housing, they were bailing out everybody in the credit sector that, you know, that was a consumer that owned a home, right?
And this was the government that was doing it with, you know, what money?
I mean, they were just printing money. They were printing money and they were buying bonds, right? And so that's where you see our debt come from, right? And so today they're buying shorter term treasuries. And the reason for that is the back end is stabilized, the housing market is stabilized, and now you're seeing the curve invert, right? And that puts a direct pinch on, you know, the financial institutions that they help bail out, and it puts a pinch on the government, right? And so what they're doing is they're buying the front end of the treasury curve to make sure that lower end of the curve interest rate and Fed funds doesn't invert. And what happened in September was money markets and overnight lending rates started to seize up. And when that occurs, all the banks that are lending each other money overnight to basically borrow money to make sure that their balance sheet is straight as they're dealing with, you know, money that they lend out and money that they need to settle in the Forex complex, they basically borrow money from each other overnight. And when they stop trading with one another, it means that there's a shortage of money out there, right? And so the government literally needs to print money. They need to go out and buy these short-term rates, and they need to basically inject the banking sector with overnight lending money. And
I feel like we keep getting whipsawed. Like, I feel like we're always talking about, oh, there's too much money in the ecosystem, and, you know, the more money there is, it means that the money that you hold is less valuable. But then we see instances like this where you talk about the repo interest rate goes up, you know, 10% for overnight lending because there's not enough money in the ecosystem. It just has us questioning, like, what is it? Is there too much money? Is there not enough money?
Yeah, I mean, that's
what is it, capital flight? What's going on?
Certainly above my pay grade when it comes to government government movements. But, you know, I think that it's a balancing act always, right? Is they went out and saved one area of the economy in a big way. And it encouraged risk-taking for a number of years now, right? You know, cheap money, go out, invest, you know, grow the economy, et cetera. But I think they expected all that to create inflation and asset valuation to increase. And really, We've only seen some of those tangible assets grow in value in certain sectors or in geographies. And then if you look at, you know, equity markets, that was where the most risk taking took place. You've got other governments printing money and buying U.S. equities with it. And so, you know, now it becomes, look at the fixed income market. And the fixed income market is telling you that, okay, reserve ratios at banks are strong. Okay, housing market is safe. You've got U.S. equities maybe even a little bit overheated. And now you got to look at fixed income and you got to say, well, who's getting pinched here? And it's governments. Governments are getting pinched. They're in negative interest rate territories. And being able to keep money in the system appropriately between the governments and the banking sectors that keep all these consumers in the economy running is a heavy balancing act.
Wow. Okay. Very cool. This is like probably one of the most informative episodes we've ever done. So thanks for shedding so much light on how all this stuff works.
Next time you guys should get an economist on here.
What
has just been said is basically, I can't go any further. I've got nothing left.
eToro is one of the largest trading platforms in the world with over $1 trillion in trading volume on the platform every year. And they're some of our good friends and they're a great sponsor. U.S. customers can trade the most popular crypto assets and your fees are extremely transparent. So if you're not ready to trade yet, you could also practice building your portfolio with the eToro virtual trading feature. They give you $100,000 of virtual money and you could start playing around with it and not have to risk any of your real money before you get comfortable with the markets. And best of all, you can connect with 12 million other eToro traders around the world, kind of like a social network for trading, to discuss charts and all things crypto. So go ahead, create an account today at eToro.com/crypto101. That helps us, that helps you, that helps them, and makes everything possible here if you guys use that link. So guys, start building your portfolio the smart way. eToro is crypto trading made easy. All right, back to the show. Well, we're going to move straight along. There's a big event. This is just, you know, going to flip the script here. So there's a big event coming called the halving in Bitcoin. And this happens every 4 years about. And it's about to happen in May 2020. So I know that we're not allowed to talk about forward-looking statements or prices. But historically, what has happened in the months leading up to the halving, like maybe call it 3 months leading into the halving and 3 months out of the halving, like historically what has happened?
Yeah. I mean, I think that one, the 3 month landscape is even a tough one to answer because I think if I were to dive back into it, and forgive me, I didn't do too much research on it, for a 3 month time frame, but I think what you find is that the market was fairly sideways. So I think what I'm looking at is the year leading up to the halving, the year and a half, the 2 years leading up to the halving, which has been historically bullish. And I don't know that it's been directly related to the halving. I think it's been demand cycles that have occurred in Bitcoin and how it touches more and more people globally just in that cycle. And it just so happens that the halving has come shortly after that. So right now, you know, I'm not sure what the halving is going to do. I can tell you that difficulty is going up, you know, pretty rapidly weekly. And I think it's around 5.2% on a weekly basis or bi-weekly basis. You've got a lot of...
Which means more miners are joining the network, right?
Yeah, it's making it harder to mine in Bitcoin, right? And so, yeah, absolutely more mining rigs are on. You've got a little earlier this year, you've got the price move up that really encouraged these guys that were hanging in there to now go full force. You know, many of them were planning during that price slump to how can we mine more? Do we have enough money to stay afloat? Okay, great. Let's mine as much as we can. And now as the prices are higher, they're just bringing more and more machines online. Now you've got all the hardware manufacturers coming out with new units that are hashing higher than they ever have, consuming more power than they ever have. And you've got a lot of these guys pushing into North America where there's cheaper, more consistent, bigger power. And so it's really quite special. I do believe all of them have financed in a big way to put themselves in a position to weather any potential next storm. And so they're looking at mining Bitcoin and not getting rid of it. And so to me, if you just look at the demand and supply here, the more access people get to from good projects, good countries making, you know, better regulation, better access to digital assets, I think it spells bullishness. I really do. But I think it's gradual in nature. I don't have any assumption or opinion that says, oh, just because we're getting 1 month closer to the halving, I expect prices to surge. I definitely do not look at it that way. I think it's about, you know, what countries are giving their people access to digital assets seamlessly. You know, how many people are gaining access to the ability to purchase Bitcoin, and how many mining networks are not selling Bitcoin. And so, you know, to me, that spells whether prices go up or go down. But in the midst of all of that, there's a very healthy market making community that now holds a very fair amount of digital assets, same in the institutional space. And so it depends on who's looking to cash in on some of their trades, or who's looking to hang on for what looks to be a decent asymmetric bet going forward into the future.
Apart from Bitcoin and Ethereum, which tokens have the deepest liquidity and strongest institutional interest? And how does an institution grade a digital asset to decide whether it's good or not?
You know, that one's tricky. I think it's about who it's touching, who it's reaching, and how it's being applied. So I think, you know, in the past, there's been, you know, a fair amount of participation in Ripple, XRP. I think you've got a lot of people that moved into stablecoins because it has a purpose. I think that, you know, our goal is to see some of that stablecoin business go into gold-backed business of ours. And then I think you've got guys looking at stuff like Maker and DAO, and how it differs from Ethereum, and how their network distribution can apply adoption. And, you know, so I think that's where I see the more institutional looks in protocols that are expanding. I even know, you know, some really, really sharp guys and that are doing stuff in Tezos with real estate already. And so I think that's another one. And going forward, you know, those are the kind of things that I think people are looking at to get, you know, big institutional participation. But there's not a huge list, in my opinion.
That's amazing. So yeah, I actually just tweeted this out the other day, because I think Maker is obviously brilliant. They're doing some of the most innovative work in the space. But it just seems like, you know, for a top 25 coin, they just trade very little 24-hour volume, you know, when you're compared to some of the other ones. Is that just because there's not a lot of supply offered on the market?
I think it's more about, you know, when people got into Ether, mining Ether and owning Ether and Ethereum-based projects, I think the activity that came in Ether was almost never meant to be there, but it was fueled by ICOs, right? It was fueled by guys who were making investments, right, liquidating investments, and there was arbitrage there, and people were actively trading it. I think today, Maker's goal is not to, you know, make sure Maker is the most traded thing out there on the global digital asset market. I think their goal is to provide, you know, adoption of the use of this for their network. And I think that it comes at a different time and a different place in this ecosystem than where Ethereum was being applied to projects.
Cool. Okay. That makes sense. So you mentioned just a second ago about your gold back product. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, what that is? And I know there's a few of them out there. So kind of what makes it
different? Yeah, absolutely. So our gold token is called USG. Stands basically for U.S. gold. What we did is we worked with a longstanding American gold dealer that is one of the few groups out there that has direct access to the U.S. Mint for the 1 ounce American Eagle gold coin. Obviously, globally, 1 ounce 1 ounce gold prices are very identifiable. They're traded on global exchanges in derivative fashion, spot fashion, and so identifying 1 ounce gold prices, I think, is really important about the space. It's the most identifiable unit of measure on the global markets, in my opinion. And so what we did is we worked with the gold dealer in an exclusive JV, And we tokenize the 1 ounce American Eagle Gold coin on the Ethereum network. It's an ERC-20 compliant token. So the differentiator here between USG and a bunch of other things that are out there on the market is that when you buy a USG token, you're buying a 1 ounce American Eagle physical gold coin that is stored in a vault in the United States, is backed by the US dollar, and is backed by the US government, because the US Mint is the ones who creates these and distributes these. So you're getting the backing of the US dollar, the denomination of the US dollar, the backing of the US government, price discovery by the US government, and I'll go into that more in detail in a second. What you see from a lot of the other participants is fractional ownership of some sort of physical piece. And so they'll let you go buy a small fractional $100 amount versus, you know, some underlying index or underlying physical gold instrument. And so when you're using this as a payment rail, that's fine, that's great, but there's nothing that's really sturdy behind it backing it. What we can do is you can buy a USG token and you can fractionalize it on the ERC20 blockchain. But you can do that for payment rails, but you can't redeem a physical, you can't redeem a fractional amount of a 1 ounce American Eagle gold coin. So you can use the fractionalization for payment rails, but you can't redeem a 1 ounce physical gold, a fractional of a 1 ounce American Eagle gold coin. You can redeem, however, a physical 1 ounce gold coin. So if you own one USG, you own the rights to the redemption of a 1 ounce physical gold coin in a vault. And you can go to our redemption process and you can go ahead and fill out your information, validate your identity and the fact that you own a 1 ounce a USG coin in your wallet, and they'll validate and verify that. And they'll go ahead and they'll work with the trust administrator and the custodian and United Parcel Pro or Brinks or whoever we choose to utilize their services for, to logistically send that physical gold coin to you if you so choose. If you want to keep it as a digital asset in your wallet and trade it against Bitcoin or trade it against fiat or trade it against another stable coin, you're always more than welcome to do that. And so BlockFills provides all of the liquidity against other digital assets. We provide distribution to other exchanges that we work with to get distribution on this. We work with custodians that hold this, and we're working with custodians and fund structures and groups like Celsius, where you can come in and you can get you can actually borrow against this. And in the future, their goal is to a number of these groups is to allow you to buy our USG token like you can Bitcoin and put it up to generate yield in the lending market just like you do your Bitcoin. So imagine today, if you were to buy a gold bar, is anybody going out there and letting you say, hey, you got a gold bar, would you like to earn a yield on it? We'll borrow that from you and we'll make it fungible to other groups and we'll earn you a yield? Not that I know of. But in the digital asset world, we can do that. And it's easy and it's safe. And custodians are a part of this. So our goal in the future is to continue to make this ecosystem more robust so that groups like Celsius and Drawbridge here in Chicago can build tools around it for people to hold a gold-backed stablecoin that has price discovery from the underlying U.S. government. Is very stable, and they can earn a yield on their gold position. And we think that's going to be super attractive to people in the future.
If I read this somewhere in a blog, I would say it's completely unbelievable and futuristic. Yet there it is. Here it is right there. So right before our eyes. So wow, great job. That's incredible. So that's got me thinking while you were talking, You know, what is the future of commodity or asset-backed crypto after the American Eagle gold coin? Like what's coming next?
Yeah, so actually, there's a great group here in Chicago that we have close ties to called Zahner Precious Metals. Zahner Precious Metals has a Zahner Digital group that's out mostly in Asia, but they actually were a helper on the Ampersand project, which is tokenizing silver and the mining community for silver. Right, so we're thinking that. You know, people getting access and exposure to raw metals through perhaps mining, mine financing. We think that there's some interesting ways that people can can earn from commodity-backed stablecoins in the future or commodity tokens. We're also already seeing guys tokenizing real estate. So not necessarily in the commodity realm, but tons of people now getting private assets to get liquidity on them and perhaps create financing structures. Like I said about those guys doing real estate on the Tezos blockchain, they're getting people, returns on their investment through staking on Tezos. Baking on Tezos, but staking through, anything else. So, I mean, these are the kind of things that I see in the future as being a huge opportunity. The crypto lending space in BTC is super saturated, in my opinion. And so creating commodity-backed digital assets that people can go out and earn yields on so that other people can trade it and provide, transparent liquid ecosystems for trade. I think it's fantastic. And trade finance in commodities is massive. So what I just talked about there could go, deeply into the future on other commodities in the trade finance sector.
Brilliant. Well, we got a couple last questions for you here. Don't want to take up too much of your time. I know you got a big meeting to go to here in just a sec. So one of the questions that we like to ask every guest that comes on the show is simple. It just, besides your company, what is another company in the space that inspires you and that you think is just doing some groundbreaking work? And we already talked a little bit about Maker and Tezos, so we'll pass on those folks too.
Yeah. So outside of guys like that, I mean, one of the best developments that we've seen, and remember that we're institutional traders, right? So, things that kind of excite me probably don't excite a lot of people.
Sure. No, that's good. We want that perspective.
But we have an absolutely fantastic relationship with a company called Fireblocks in the space. We think Fireblocks has created really a set of tools and opportunities for large institutions to actually solve problems in the space. So, I mean, if you look at like a group like BitGo, who came out, early in the space, they look to me like they're seizing. And, the tools that they're providing are the same tools that everybody else is providing from in a little bit more archaic nature. You see Anchorage coming out, and Anchorage has, a little bit savvier way of doing things. And they've got, the special guys from Silicon Valley that are backing it. And so it gets a lot of attention and a lot of adoption, right? But when you get down to the nitty gritty, if you look at Fireblocks and the MPC technology that they're using and the tools that they're actually providing, digital asset traders to utilize, is the absolute future of the space. And what you're going to find is that, in Bitcoin and in Ether and all these other, cryptos that people like to trade now, that's just this really tiny market. When you think about digital assets, you're going to get into stocks, digital securities, et cetera, right? And when you get into that space, you've got institutions out there already that custody their own assets, right? They've got their own books. They've got prime brokers. They've got banks, right? And so the technology that Fireblocks is using is applicable to all types of institutions out there, and giving them the power to keep safety of their assets on their own books under self-custody rather than using outside custodians. So the custodian space to me is saturated. There's only a couple of really, really dominant, players that everybody's going to want to utilize. And then when you get outside of it, we're talking about custody tools for institutions that go way beyond Bitcoin. And Fireblocks is that company. They got an investment from Fidelity and a number of other groups. We were using them in beta while they were still in stealth. A number of other great prominent groups in the space utilize their technology and their services and products. And what we're doing next with them that we're going to roll out this quarter is going to be a first of its kind in the space. And I think the type of technology they're using for the future of institutional crypto adoption is absolutely an integral part of the future. And I certainly applaud them for all that they do for the space.
I'm so glad you brought them up, because one of the things that keeps me up at night is the fact that, as we always said in the space, not your keys, not your crypto. But we're moving into a time now where security is harder than ever. And even some countries now are passing regulations saying that if you're a fund manager, you have to have a third party verified custodian to hold your funds, because they just simply decided they don't want to trust people with their own money anymore, which is insanely anti-crypto, but this is the world that we're living in now. So what do we do? How do we self-custody but have the confidence of a private custodian? So hopefully Fireblocks is the solution to that.
Well, you know, I think first and foremost, you look at what we were struggling to find before we actually knew Fireblocks was coming out, was we were struggling to find a solution that made sense for traders, right? All the guys that we work with, they're not the buy and hold guys. And we have some of those for sure. But they're the guys that are constantly moving assets and are continuously responsible and accountable for their own actions, right? These are guys that take risk. They know how to manage their risk. And for that, they're not going to pay a custodian to manage their assets. They're never going to do it. It'll never happen. They're going to take responsibility for their own actions. It's their assets, right? So when you look at that, Fireblocks came out and listen, I mean, they talked to us and they said, what are you seeing in the space? And we told them, and Michael is a fantastic listener. He has a great team, and their team constantly rolls out things, products, and certain pieces of technology that they've heard from their clients. And that's something that I really think that nobody else is doing. If you look at custodians, they're like, here's my product, take it or leave it. I'm a custodian, right? And the custodians, they only cater to the business, like hedge funds, that absolutely need a third-party custodian to manage those assets, right? But these guys actually listen to their clients, they take from that, and they build tools that actually work. They make operating efficiencies, they make things safer, they make it so that it's harder to make mistakes. And these are the things that are absolutely integral to growing this ecosystem. And so you know, that's how we feel about that. And then when you get into the much bigger space, which is digital assets, and when that regulation comes, and who the people in the space that are going to have the greatest benefit when that comes, these guys are going to need tools like this, because they don't have it built and they're not going to go build it. They're going to go look for the best technology in the space that's backed by, you know, a major, major institution, and that's Fireblocks. And so I really, really continue to work hard on different things with them, and what we're going to roll out here next, I think everyone's going to be really, really happily surprised by. It's the things that people have been waiting for a year plus in the space, and it's finally going to get delivered. So, you know, we'll keep you guys posted on that, maybe give you guys a first look at announcing
it. And, Neil, I was going to say, I'd appreciate the introduction to those cats, and I literally took the words out of my mouth. I'd love to do like an exclusive or something. So we'll back channel on that.
Yeah, totally. So, you know, that's my thoughts there. And, you know, there's a lot of other people that are building all kinds of things to support blockchain that I don't even understand. And, you know, they have fantastic companies out there and whatnot. But this is the stuff that hits home for our business and the people we do business with. And I can't thank them enough for, you know, all the good things they do for the space.
Beautiful. Last quick question before we let you go. If this was the very first podcast that somebody in cryptocurrency was listening to, what's one word of advice that you would give to a novice cryptocurrency guy?
It's really one sentence. It's do your own research, take your time, evaluate the risks of who, what, and where you take risk with or at. If you're looking to fund your account in an exchange, you better know everything about how that works and understand the risks that you're taking. If you're trading with someone, you better know, you know, the reputability of who you're trading with. And when it comes down to it, you know, if you're, you know, gambling in this business with money of yours, you better do your own research. You better take your time. This for as fast as this ecosystem moves, if you sit back and take your time, you'll find that it's all right there in front of you, and you can take your sweet time and make your decisions, and you're not missing out on a thing.
Beautiful. Yeah. I mean, couldn't have said it better, Neil. And couldn't have been more thrilled to have you as a guest. This was very enlightening, and can't wait to have you back someday in the future, man. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us, guys. Happy to be on anytime, and look forward to working with you guys in the future.
Thanks again, Neil. I've learned so much today. We will definitely be in touch. Can't wait to see you again.
All right. Talk soon, guys.